Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to today's call on treating pregnant women's tobacco use and dependence. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Anne Wedland. Ms. Wedland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Ryan. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, Cessation Programs Manager for the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the Smokers Quit Line, I would like to welcome you to today's call, Treating Pregnant Women's Tobacco Use and Dependence. You may view today's presentation in one of two ways, as a webinar or by downloading the slides posted on the New York State Smokers Quit Line website. Links to the slides and webinar posted on the collaborative call page of the New York State Smokers Quit Line website, nysmokefree.com. To access today's presentation, go to nysmokefree.com. On the left-hand side of the website's homepage, there is a newsfeed section. Within this section, there is an announcement for today's call. Click on the link provided, and it will bring you to the page for today's webinar. On the same page, under Tools, you will find a list of New York State Cessation Centers with their respective service areas. The Cessation Center staff are available to assist your organization with developing and implementing tobacco dependence treatment policies and clinical protocols. Our featured speakers today are Dr. Griffin Zimboykin. Dr. Todd Griffin is a chair for the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Medicine at Stony Brook University Hospital. Dr. Rachel Boykin is an assistant professor of clinical pediatrics at Stony Brook Long Island Children's Hospital, where she is a pediatric hospitalist and associate pediatric residency director. On today's call, Dr. Griffin will describe evidence-based interventions to help pregnant smokers quit, assess an organization's guidelines to treat pregnant women's tobacco use with evidence-based treatment recommendations, and discuss at least one gain and one challenge when treating pregnant women's tobacco use during the course of the pregnancy and postpartum. Dr. Boykin will review harmful effects of second and third-hand smoke on children, describe OptiQuit referral program at Stony Brook Long Island Children's Hospital, and share preliminary data from a survey of smoking parents of newborns. We are pleased to offer CME, CRCE, and OASES continuing education credits to listeners of today's presentation. To fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Griffin and Dr. Boykin have no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor do they have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. To obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms posted on the website. In addition, at the end of the webinar, you can complete the forms online if you prefer. A link to the online forms will be provided in the webinar chat box and on the Quitline site. Please remember, applications for credits will not be accepted after March 12th. That is 1 week from today, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Dr. Todd Griffin. Dr. Griffin?
Thank you, Ann. I just would like to point out, I just received a few chats from people who said they can't hear anything, so I'm not sure if there's a problem with the audio, but I've received a couple of messages.
Thank you. I'll put the phone number in the chat box. Thanks.
So thank you again for having me. I think it's hopefully will be a very good webinar. We're going to have two different presenters, as was mentioned, myself and Dr. Boykin. I'm going to be talking first about basically how we deal with pregnant women and treating pregnant women for tobacco use. So I'll be navigating through the slides. First of all, I have no conflict of interest in this presentation, and I currently and have never been a smoker in the past, so I hope that's a good thing. And as Ann had mentioned before, our objectives are really to describe two evidence-based interventions to help pregnant smokers quit, assess an organizational guidelines to treat pregnant women's tobacco use with evidence-based treatment, and again, talk about the challenges that occur in trying to treat pregnant women as well as while they're pregnant as well as in the postpartum stages. When we look at different disease processes that impact women during pregnancy, it's actually somewhat of a shame that tobacco smoking is still one of the leading causes that we see. So obviously we know that obesity, depression, maternal age, and inadequate prenatal care all impact pregnancy outcomes, impact fetuses as well as newborns. But the fact that tobacco use is still at about 11% of our population in the United States is somewhat disturbing. And when we look at women who are more likely to smoke in pregnancy, we see that it tends to be women of a lower socioeconomic class. And remember, these women are already somewhat disadvantaged, that they probably have less access to prenatal care to begin with. They tend to have a lower educational level. So again, how their prenatal care progresses is affected by that. They tend to be younger. They tend to be unmarried. They tend to have higher parity, meaning it's been, this is maybe their second or third pregnancy, and they have a lower level of social support. So again, their ability to just have a positive impact in their pregnancy to begin with is already affected. Now adding smoking on top of that complicates it even further. And then even more disturbingly is that internationally, the World Health Organization has shown that the incidence of women smoking is increasing, especially in low-income, high-population countries. So we're really kind of losing this battle among our young pregnant patients. And we know, that our ability to treat women's tobacco use and dependency can really impact the overall pregnancy. It's probably one of the most important, potentially preventable causes of adverse pregnancy outcomes. We know that smoking increases the risk of placental abruption, where the placenta separates prematurely from the uterus. This can affect fetal growth. This can affect preterm delivery. We know that it increases the risk for miscarriage as well as preterm birth. And we do see that on most women, I guess, would want to have a smaller baby, but in reality, low birth weight is not a good thing for a fetus or an infant, and as well as obviously abnormal fetal growth and intrauterine growth restriction. And then the ultimate bad outcome is obviously stillbirth. And we know that from a number of studies that stillbirth has been shown to be increased with tobacco usage. As well as not only are there pregnancy outcomes that occur, but we know that there's long-term adverse effects on the neonates as well as children. So we see higher rates of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in children whose mom smoked. We see increased risk of asthma. There seems to be adverse effects overall on the immune system, and then there may be some increased risk of childhood cancers. So overall, again, we see that there's not only is affecting the fetal environment, but also affecting the neonatal and infant environment as well. When we talk about risk of stillbirth, probably the best study that was done was from the NICHDD. This was done from March 2006 to September 2008. And what they did in this case is they looked at, they matched patients who had stillbirths and women who had live births, and they looked at a couple of things. This was done prospectively. They looked at women's self-reporting of smoking. In other words, women were asked how much did they smoke during the pregnancy, how much did they smoke different trimesters. And then on top of that, they also checked umbilical blood levels of cotinin, which is the byproduct of nicotine, at the time of delivery, as well as maternal levels. So that way they could assess what was the fetal exposure to nicotine as well as the maternal level. This was one of the first studies that actually correlated not only maternal reporting of smoking as well as actual having physiologic data looking at blood levels and umbilical cord levels. And then their overall outcome of the study was to look at risk of stillbirth. And this was, again, published just recently in January of 2014. And when you looked at women who had self-reporting smoking of 1 to 9 cigarettes per day or over 10 cigarettes per day, you can see that the risk of stillbirth nearly doubled, as well as you saw that was correlated well between the actual blood samples of the umbilical cord or the maternal blood, showing, again, about a 2 to 2.5-fold increase in stillbirth among those women who smoked. What was also interesting about this study was they did notice that there was a dose response effect, meaning that as there was an increase in the exposure and amount of exposure, there was also an increased risk of the stillbirth. And this helped to strengthen the biological plausibility of the association between tobacco use and stillbirth. Other studies have also looked at not only maternal smoking, but what is the impact of secondhand smoke or environmental smoke on pregnancies? This first study, which was published in Pediatrics in 2011, looked at secondhand smoke in pregnancy. It was a meta-analysis of 19 different studies. And in this case, they were able to demonstrate that even secondhand smoke had an increased risk of stillbirth by about 23% and an increased risk of congenital malformation of about 13%, as well as overall a slight increase in risk of the spontaneous abortion or miscarriage. A second study looked at just environmental tobacco smoke. This looked at women who potentially were exposed to smoke in their workplace or in other environments. It was a retrospective cohort study, involved almost 12,000 women. And again, in this case, they were looking at, as a primary outcome, looking at birth weight, birth length, head circumference, and stillbirth. And in this case, they found that women who were exposed to environmental tobacco had a lower mean birth rate, had smaller head circumference and birth length. They actually, in this case, had a higher stillbirth rate that was even seen in our prior studies, almost an odds ratio of 3 times, and again having an increased risk of preterm birth and neonatal sepsis. I actually like this cartoon because I like the idea of the smoke-filled womb. That just sounded kind of terrible to me, so I put that in there. And then there's also been looking at really at the pathologic level to see what is tobacco use actually, how does it impact the placentas? And this was a study that was one of the earlier studies that was published in the obstetric and gynecology literature. And what they did is they examined placentas from patients who reported heavy smoking and from 20 patients who reported non-smoking. And they looked at these patients who were undergoing termination of pregnancy at 9 to 14 weeks. So the idea here was to look at early placental pathology in women who otherwise would, quote, have a normal pregnancy that then was terminated and look at the differences that smoking had on the early placental pathology. And they actually saw that very early on there was villous changes as well as morphologic changes in the trophoblast that were occurring. And their conclusion from this was that really we need to be thinking about how do we stop patients from smoking earlier the better, and really ideally prior to pregnancy even begins, because we may not be able to reverse some of the placental changes that occur if we're only getting women to stop in the first trimester or second trimester. Now, when you look at women who become pregnant and who smoke, many of them right away, right after they learn they're pregnant, are going to continue to smoke. But then as they start to deal with the fact that they are now pregnant, you'll see that a large number of them, and you'll see about half of them are going to quit smoking initially in the first trimester. Many of them revert to that in the first trimester and the second trimester. They continue to smoke. Then when they get closer to third trimester is when they stop smoking again. There's this kind of this thing that goes on in the maternal psyche that says, you know what, I found out I'm pregnant, I stopped smoking, then I start smoking again in the first and second trimester, but then as I get closer to delivery, I think, okay, I have to stop again. As well as there's even women, some women who actually smoke more in the first trimester, and we see this over and over again, that there's fluctuations in the smoking that occurs. In one study that was done in January 2003, they looked at 1,400 women who were smoking during pregnancy. 60% of the women continued to smoke. They never stopped, and they continued to smoke throughout their pregnancy. A large number of women, about 38%, quit for a week, but then many of them relapsed. So you constantly have this relapsing that's occurring during pregnancy, where they stop, they quit, they stop, and they continue. And so it's we need to understand that even if we are able to get them to quit smoking initially, we have to have repeated interventions to really promote smoking cessation throughout the entire pregnancy. And I think that's one of the challenges that we have, is how do we get people who quit and then to maintain quitting throughout the entire pregnancy and postpartum period. Now, unfortunately, when we look at how do we get women to stop smoking during pregnancy, there's a number of different interventions. There's psychosocial interventions and pharmacologic interventions. And unfortunately, many of these have not really been overly successful. There was a great Cochrane review that came out in 2013 that looked a lot of the different psychosocial interventions, and they broke them down into counseling, what they called health education, feedback, incentive-based interventions, and social support. So counseling included motivational interviewing. They did cognitive behavioral therapy. They did psychotherapy, hypnosis, relaxation, a lot of different things tied into counseling. Many of this was either face-to-face. Some of it was by telephone. Some of it was by interactive computer programs. So there's a number of different interventions that they looked at, and these were studies that had been previously obviously published on all these different techniques. They also looked at health education, where women early in pregnancy were provided information about the risk of smoking. And then in many of those studies, those patients may have actually even had an updated information throughout the pregnancy, where maybe they were getting automatic texts to their telephone, et cetera, trying to remind them to not to smoke. Feedback methods were actually where the mother was receiving information about their fetal health. That included ultrasound monitoring, where potentially they were looking at fetal growth and fetal indications on ultrasound, or they were looking at urinary carbon monoxide or cotinine levels during the pregnancy and feeding that information back to the mother for her to understand that the nicotine or the smoking that she was doing was actually was being seen in the maternal blood and potentially having a fetal effect. The last two interventions were incentive-based interventions, and in this case, they actually gave financial incentive for mothers to quit smoking during pregnancies. These included gift vouchers, gift cards, a number of different things that the patients could receive. And then finally, social support was where peers and or a partner were involved in also trying to help the mother stop smoking during the pregnancy. Now, when they looked at all these different techniques for smoking cessation, they found that counseling did seem to have somewhat of a positive effect, meaning that there was some decrease in smoking cessation. Health education really had mixed results throughout the studies. There really wasn't evidence, plus or minus, that just educating patients about the risks of smoking were going to be enough. Giving feedback really only had minimal effect. Believe it or not, even moms looking at their ultrasounds or looking at urinary and blood levels of cotinine as well as carbon monoxide did not have as a large effect as they had thought it would be. And overall, the one that seemed to have the most positive impact was an incentive-based program. But it had to be an intense program. I mean, it had to be, they were constantly being incentivized with gift cards, et cetera, or gift vouchers to stop smoking. Unfortunately, that becomes a very difficult program to maintain, to fund. And then again, who's providing that funding is always an issue. Interestingly, when it looked at social support, if it was the partner or the husband in this case, or the or partner, that was providing the support, there really was no benefit. Whereas if it was a peer, there seemed to be some minor impact positively on tobacco cessation. Cochrane also did a review of pharmacologic interventions. And realistically, the pharmacologic interventions that exist right now are nicotine replacement therapies, and there's a number of different ways to do that. Then you have your varenicline, which is your Chantix, also known as Chantix, and bupropion, which is, again, an antidepressant that has been used for smoking cessation. And this review came out from Cochrane in 2012, and when they looked at the overall success rate of nicotine replacement therapy, there was really insufficient evidence to support whether the fact that it was efficacious or that it was safe to use in pregnancy. They really showed mixed fetal and infant outcomes, some positive, some negative. So overall, when they looked at these studies as a whole, they really couldn't make any recommendations about, is this something we should be using? They did note that overall, in their meta-analysis, that there was an increased risk of C-section noted for women who had nicotine replacement therapy. And again, that may be related to, again, that some of these things still have some effects on the placenta. And that overall, there was really no better effect for nicotine replacement therapy over placebo. When we look at Zyban or bupropion, again, there's really limited studies in pregnancy that have been looking at it prospectively. Most animal and human data does not really demonstrate any risk of fetal malformations. There was one retrospective study that did show an increased risk of left outflow tract heart defects if it was used around the time of conception. Again, that's a very small study. So it seems that it's probably safe, that it probably does not cause, it's probably not a teratogen or cause congenital malformations, but the overall wasn't seen to really improve the rate of changing any of the fetal outcomes. One other study that was done that actually came out in the British Journal of OBGYN in 2012 that has a little different than what the Cochrane review showed was a meta-analysis looking at pharmacotherapy for smoking cessation in pregnancy. In this case, they looked at 74 different articles, but they only included the 7 randomized controlled studies that were done out of those 74 articles. And they only evaluated nicotine replacement therapy. And in this case, they did see that there was an increased risk of abstinence rate for women who were taking or were utilizing the nicotine replacement therapies, so that about 2 times the amount of women were able to maintain abstinence. But when they really broke down the 7 studies, there was only 3 that used a placebo control. So the question again becomes is, and in that group, there was no increased risk of increased efficacy for smoking abstinence. So the question becomes, is this any really better than placebo? And again, I think that still becomes a question that we still needs to be answered. And again, their conclusion from this was that we really needed larger randomized controlled trials that are going to be prospectively done to see how can we improve, again, the outcomes and increasing the rate of abstinence. It's not only that we have to talk to the patients about abstinence and smoking cessation, but we also still have a lot of work to do with OBGYNs nationally about how do they interact with their patients who are smoking. So ACOG, the American College of OBGYN, did a survey. There was 252 respondents, and believe it or not, wasn't 100% screened for tobacco use at their initial visit. Only about 88% of obstetricians, gynecologists are actually screening for tobacco use at the first prenatal visit, and then only about 60% ever discuss it afterwards at subsequent visits. And then when a patient who is using tobacco during the pregnancy, only about a third of those obstetricians actually communicate that information to the pediatricians at time of delivery. And we know and we'll see from Dr. Boykin's presentation that obviously giving that information to the pediatrician is important as well, because that's, again, another healthcare provider that can be working with that family to try to do tobacco cessation. And then when they talked about what are the different methods that the obstetricians, gynecologists are using in their practices for educating their patients, most of them are just recommending abstinence. Some recommend reduction in cigarette usage, and many of them review reasons for quitting, but are not utilizing many of the other techniques on a routine basis that we had previously discussed. And when they talked about why are the reasons that they're not interacting with their patients more regarding tobacco cessation, the number one reason was time, not having the actual time to spend with the patients to discuss this, to educate the patients, to make the patients understand the importance. Second was that they felt that many of the patients actually would be resistant to treatment, or that it might turn off the patients if they were constantly focusing on their tobacco use. And then third was the fact that they felt that they really didn't have a good source of referral resources available for their patients who were smoking. And in a different article, they looked at, I'm sorry, the same article, they looked at what would things would they want to have in their practices if they could. So most of them obviously wanted a way to be able to easily screen patients. They wanted a way to educate patients both during the pregnancy and the postpartum periods, and then they wanted ways for able to be able to have resources to interact with patients on a more intense basis during the pregnancy. Obviously, they didn't have these resources themselves. So overall, you know, we know that there's many multiple adverse fetal and neonatal outcomes that are associated with not only primary tobacco use, but secondary tobacco use, whether that's through secondhand smoke or other environmental risk factors. And we know that many women are going to relapse. They may quit initially, but they're going to relapse during the pregnancy. They're going to continue to smoke. So we have to have strategies that not only get them to quit, but then help them sustain abstinence throughout the pregnancy and then hopefully for the rest of their lives. That many of the psychosocial therapies that we have minimal impact. The one that seems to, again, have the most impact, again, is some type of incentive-based program, and that we need further research on the pharmacotherapy and interventions because at the current state, we don't really think they're much better than placebo. And then we need to really do some education with our obstetricians and gynecologists nationally on how they can do a better job at this. And I think one of the things I'm very interested in is learning more about how we can use the program that Dr. Boykin has been using in our pediatric population during in our obstetrical population early in pregnancy. So at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Boykin so she can talk about what she's all the exciting stuff she's been doing. And thank you very much, and we'll take questions at the end.
Thank you, Todd, and already lots of food for thought. I'm going to touch on some of the things that Dr. Griffin mentioned and focus mostly on how we have implemented the New York State OptiQuit program at our hospital and also, as was mentioned earlier, some results of a survey of parents that we've just started working on. I also have no disclosures, and no, I have never smoked either. These are my objectives for this portion, again, to just review the harmful effects of second and third-hand smoke on children, to describe our implementation of the OptiQuit program, and then to share some preliminary data from our survey. So my disclaimer initially, I have a bias. I'm a pediatrician, as Ann mentioned, and so I'm particularly concerned about the effects of secondhand smoke on children. So I'm going to just start by reviewing some general statistics, which may be familiar to a lot of you. First, based on the 2012 Behavior Risk Factor Surveillance System data, 16.2% of adults in New York State are smokers. This is better than the national average of roughly 19%, but we still have far to go. At our hospital, approximately 11% of parents of babies in the neonatal intensive care unit, or NICU, are smokers. Some studies have reported parents to have lower baseline quit rates than the general population of smokers. And as Dr. Griffin mentioned, up to 50% of women who have quit or cut back during pregnancy may start smoking again after their baby is born. So clearly we have work to do as pediatricians. Now, I expect that all who are listening are well aware of the dangers of secondhand smoke and what that is. It's the smoke exhaled from smoking or from the burning tip of a cigarette. Secondhand smoke is comprised of more than 4,000 chemicals. Secondhand smoke was first mentioned in the Surgeon General's report 42 years ago in 1972, so we've known about this for a long time. It was recognized as harmful to children in 1974. Now, exposure to children from secondhand smoke is declining in many parts of the country as a result of broader no-smoking policies and workplace bans, so this is all good. However, 11% of children are still exposed to secondhand smoke, the majority from their parents in their own homes. And as all listening probably know, secondhand smoke can cause significant morbidity and even mortality in children, including increased risk of sudden infant death, or SIDS, asthma, ear infections, pneumonia. It also has significant effects on premature infants whose lungs are already compromised by their being premature. So as was stated clearly in the 2006 Surgeon General's report, there is no risk-free level of exposure to secondhand smoke. Now, the dangers of third-hand smoke have been described more recently. The term was reportedly coined in 2006. Third-hand smoke is what remains in an environment after the cigarette is extinguished. Residual pollutants include toxic and carcinogenic components, and they remain in the dust and on surfaces. They can even be re-emitted into a gas phase. So young children, as they crawl around the furniture and eat everything that they come in contact with, they're particularly at risk. They have significant dermal contact with the skin, and as I mentioned, they may even ingest particles. So with that background, I want to switch gears and discuss what we as healthcare providers do to address the issue of smoking exposure of our patients. Specifically, how do we address smoking cessation in the inpatient setting? Our standard procedure, which I think is reflective of general what people generally do, has been to provide information on the smoker's and smoking's effect on health, to encourage the smoker to quit, give them a referral to the quit line, provide written materials, if we do anything at all. But is there more? What else can we do? So studies looking at smoking cessation programs in the inpatient setting suggest that perhaps more focused, more intense, or combination interventions may work well. So I want to give some examples. A recent meta-analysis from a few years ago highlighted the importance of intensive inpatient counseling sessions with one-month follow-up. Dr. Jonathan Winnikoff is a pediatrician who's done a lot of work in this area, and his study, the NEW study, focused on parents of newborns. Other studies have looked at smoking cessation programs targeting parents of children hospitalized with respiratory illness, which of course would make sense. And then the STOP program, also Dr. Winnikoff, utilized a number of concurrent approaches, counseling sessions, nicotine replacement, phone calls, follow-up, et cetera. So a few years ago, as I was pondering how we could better address smoking cessation with the parents of our hospitalized patients, I learned about the New York State OptiQuit program. So Pat Bax will mention this a little later, but I'm going to describe it as background for what we've done. This program takes the referral of a smoker to the quit line and essentially systematizes it by incorporating it into the institution's intake process. All smokers admitted to the hospital are told they will be referred to the quit line unless they opt out, and their information is entered directly into the computer and electronically transferred to the quit line. The smoker then receives phone calls, nicotine replacement, gum, et cetera, by the quit line. So realizing what a great opportunity this was for us, I initiated a collaborative process between Stony Brook Children's and the New York State Quit Line. And at this point, we are the first and so far the only children's hospital to participate. So here you see a poster displayed in our inpatient units and a button that we have for the staff to publicize our partnership with OptiQuit. The process of referral with OptiQuit is really quite simple. The nurse or other healthcare provider asks the caregiver whether or not they smoke or have smoked in the past 12 months. And here you can see a screenshot. This is from within our electronic medical record. And the yellow are required fields. And as they get completed, they turn yellow or go away. Once someone is identified as a smoker, the text box that you see here appears, and the nurse reads this. This explains the program, and consent is implied by providing the necessary information for the referral, the name, the date of birth, the phone number. And this text was approved by our HIPAA and legal counsels. Now, at the time of implementing OptiQuit, we had had a full electronic medical record in our children's hospital for at least a year. But we had some challenges, which I'm going to go through now. While the screen for OptiQuit is really quite simple, as you just saw, it was difficult to know the best way to incorporate it into the nurse's workflow. Because we wanted to be able to have the task repeated throughout the hospital stay for any smoker visiting the child, we initially made it what we call here a continuous task. This is one that appears and reappears on the nurse's task list. It works well if everyone remembers to do it and is committed to doing it and isn't annoyed by it and just close the screen. The other option that we talked about initially was what we call a forced function. It's not really forced, it's required, and it becomes overdue if it's not completed. This is something that has to be completed. So once it is done, it goes away. So the advantage is that it really does have to be done. The disadvantage is that once it's done, we don't have the option to continue to enroll visitors and family members if they arrived after the initial intake of the child. So after a year of doing this, we've decided to change to a mixed model. So now we will have an initial forced or required function, and then what we call an ad hoc task, which again is like a continuous task that will have to be picked from a menu that can be done at any time. So if a visitor comes in, you can tell their smoker, or you ask if they're a smoker, they want to be referred, we can just do that right then and there. We're still evaluating which is the best model. The other thing that came up in our implementation of OptiQuit were some legal issues. because we're a children's hospital. OptiQuit was designed to refer patients, adult patients, admitted to the hospital as part of the hospital protocol. However, our patients are children, and their families are not admitted. So this created a challenge because we couldn't give them an encounter number as a patient. So they're now identified by their relationship to the child. The other thing that came up was that because we're not referring our patients, our legal counsel felt that we had to modify the wording of OptiQuit. Rather than strongly wording that the default is the referral unless you opt out, that we strongly recommend the referral. And finally, it took some work between both the IT specialists at our institution and at the New York State Quit Line to have automatic electronic transmission of information. The initial proposal involved having an extra sign-on for the nurses to the New York State Quit Line website, and that was not tenable at all for their workflow, so we ditched that pretty quickly. Now we have expanded the task to include attending physicians and residents, and this improves the number of opportunities to enroll the patient's family, especially those who are coming and going from the hospital at any hour of the day or night, so that's a good thing. But in the end, it is a culture change for everyone, and it takes time. It takes time. Now, at the same time that we implemented OptiQuit, I received a grant from the American Academy of Pediatrics Richmond Center to survey smoking parents of newborns admitted to the regular newborn nursery and to the neonatal intensive care unit. The goal of the survey, which was adapted and compiled from several validated and publicly available surveys, is to identify any factors predictive of motivation and success in quitting smoking among parents of newborns. Our primary question is whether parents of sicker children, for example those in the NICU, are more or less likely to quit smoking or to consider quitting. Follow-up data 6 to 8 months after the referral time from the New York State Quit Line regarding quit rates and from our phone calls will be merged with information from the surveys that we've gathered. So we completed data collection at the end of 2013, so what I have to present here today is preliminary and includes only a portion of all surveys collected. But there's some interesting things to notice here. First of all, demographics of our sample are representative of the larger community, and Dr. Griffin alluded to some of this in terms of the educational levels and income levels. Here on the top left, you can notice that the majority are Caucasian, followed by African American and Hispanics. Also notice that the education and income level of smokers in our sample is predictably low. Over half had completed only high school, or not even. Almost half earn less than $20,000 per year. And as a point of reference, the per capita income based on 2010 to 2012 data in Suffolk County where we live is around $36,000. So those who are smoking are those who can least afford it. So we were also interested to know who would accept referral to OptiQuit. Would the health status of the baby play a role? Recall some prior studies I mentioned that showed success with target populations such as newborns or children with respiratory illness. So we found that 53% of smoking NICU parents, parents of babies in the neonatal intensive care unit, accepted referral, compared with almost 80% of parents of babies in the regular newborn nursery. This statistically significant difference suggests a difference in readiness to quit. What else did we learn? From 61 total surveys analyzed to date, we learned that 86.4% of parents had tried to quit upon learning of the pregnancy. 91% of them were mothers and 69% of fathers. 43% had cut back. 27.6% quit completely. And 10.3% quit later in pregnancy. This is exactly what Dr. Griffin's data predicted, and we saw it right here. We saw that more mothers than fathers quit or cut back for pregnancy or child-related reasons. More mothers than fathers had been counseled regarding smoking cessation during prenatal visits by a physician. And these are all areas which I think are interesting and certainly deserve further study. And finally, no talk would be complete without a little mention of e-cigarettes. 51% of our sample had tried e-cigarettes, 58% in order to quit smoking, and 83% instead of regular cigarettes. So clearly the use of e-cigarettes in our population is prevalent, and it also mirrors national trends. So where are we now? Smokers enrolled in the OptiQuit program will be followed up by the New York State Quit Line in approximately 7 months post-enrollment. Those who completed the survey that we gave them but did not accept enrollment in OptiQuit will be called by our research team about the same time, 7 months post-survey collection. This is to evaluate whether they have quit or cut back their smoking. Then we plan to compare the quit data from the Quit Line and our follow-up phone calls with the questionnaire results to see if we can identify relevant factors for future study and even intervention. We continue to improve referrals through the nurse and physician education, And we're also in the process of expanding the OptiQuit program here to the outpatient and emergency department settings. Ideally, if we can identify factors or a group of people who might be more ready to quit smoking, we will be better able to initiate targeted smoking cessation services directly in the inpatient setting to work in conjunction with referrals to OptiQuit. So with that, I will stop. This is just some references for anybody who's interested in reading a little bit more, and say thank you and turn it back over to our moderators for questions.
Hi, Dr. Boykin. This is Pat Bax, the marketing coordinator with the New York State Smokers Quit Line. Before we open it up for questions, I just wanted to take a moment to thank you and Dr. Griffin for your excellent and very informative presentations. I also want to welcome our new and returning participants who are joining us today, and we certainly encourage you to continue to participate in our future conference calls. If you are not familiar with the New York State Smokers Quit Line, we are a free, confidential, and evidence-based cessation service. And we are located at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. And we do provide free help and resources for everyone in New York State. We offer free coaching, nicotine replacement patches, motivational support, a wide range of resources. As those of you that have accessed our information on the website, you can see the breadth of materials that we have available. We have messaging and an online community. And for our providers on the call today, as you heard from Dr. Boykin's presentation, we have a referral program that does include an optional OptiQuit program that is a systematic program and adoption of a policy. We have valuable resources. We have downloadable materials, fact sheets, especially for chronic diseases, and fact sheets on pregnancy. And you can find it more information under the Health Provider and Partner section at nysmokefree.com. If you are looking for more details and more assistance for how you can incorporate OptiQuit or our provider referral program into your service, please contact the Quit Line directly at 1-866-697-8487 for more information. And thank you for participating on our call today and for all your assistance in helping your tobacco-using patients to become and to stay tobacco-free. At this time, we will open it up for questions. Ryan, if you could open it up for questions, that would be great.
Certainly. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they were received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. Please hold while we wait for the first question. Once again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's the number 7 on your telephone keypad. First question comes from Laura Giardino. Laura, please state your question.
My staff and I here in Suffolk County Department of Health were wondering how are pregnant women that contact this quit line managed? Are they offered the patch and the gum, or are they just doing telephone counseling?
Hi, thank you for the question. This is Pat from the Quit Line. At this point, we are unable to provide patches to women who are pregnant. We need to follow the manufacturer's recommendations. And however, we do provide very robust coaching using, as Dr. Griffin mentioned, you know, the importance of motivational interviewing and motivational coaching. Our coaches are trained in that area, as well as they specifically are trained to help pregnant women address their triggers and also encourage them to recontact us after they are after they give birth, so that they can continue to work with us as we help them, either if they haven't been able to successfully quit or to help them sustain their quit or begin to make a quit attempt, as long as they're not pregnant or breastfeeding.
Yeah, I'd like to add one other thing. I think one of the things that we're not addressing during pregnancy is the spouse. And I think there's a real opportunity, because no one really looked at what has been the relapse of patients where the spouse also smokes. So that obviously can be a trigger. And I think one of the things that becomes the opportunity here is for us to refer the husbands or the spouses of the pregnant woman, and then hopefully decrease that either secondary hand smoke that they're receiving or potentially the triggers for relapse of their own smoking. And that can be involved, and for, obviously for the spouse, you can offer them the patch, the gum, et cetera.
Yes, and we definitely provide, we'll provide that for not only the spouse, but also other family members or friends who are in need of nicotine replacement therapy and assistance in quitting smoking. That's a great point. Thank you, Dr. Griffin.
The next question comes from Robin Clark. I'm sorry, she dropped off. The next question comes from Madeline Cruz. Madeline, please state your question.
Yes, my question, Ashley. My name is Madeline Cruz. I work at the Harlem Hospital with the pregnant moms who smoke. And my question is, after all the studies giving that we just heard about the NRTs, so at this point, your hospital in Buffalo, you don't offer any NRTs at all at the pregnant moms. And the reason why I say that is because here at the Harlem Hospital, I usually, since 2009, we give the nicotine gum to pregnant moms. And it has been successful. So any reason why you're not giving any at all NRT replacement treatment?
So we actually, and now remember, it's different. At Stony Brook, we actually do use some of the NRT in our pregnant patients, but that's different from what the Department of Health OptiQuit is able to offer. So we do on an individual basis use it with our patients. But I think the important thing to look at is we may subjectively think that we're having an improved outcome for our patients, but overall the data doesn't really show that.
The other thing I just, this is Dr. Boykin, I just want to jump in because I found it very interesting. You know, we're all stuck with a difficult situation here if you're talking about a woman who's pregnant, and obviously we all want her to quit. You know, the studies don't show a large positive effect, as Dr. Griffin outlined. But the other thing is you're looking at side effects, and I think a lot of people, when I speak with the women who've given birth, they say, well, we tried, but, you know, we know there's side effects of this. But, you know, what we can't do and what we haven't been able to do is really compare the side effect profile of, say, the gum, which might be used, as we say, off-label at some level, with if you kept smoking, which Dr. Griffin pointed out quite well, the effects, I think, are probably worse.
Right.
But, you know, we're looking for, you know, nobody wants anything that has any side effects. But sometimes we're stuck kind of having to do things that are not, we don't have data for. And I think this is clearly an area that we have to look further into because something has to be done.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Diane Oldenburg. Diane, please state your question.
I think we already had it answered, but with the texting program, do you have messages that are geared specifically to pregnant women?
Hi, this is Pat again. We have actually different code words that you can actually type in. They're not specifically directed to pregnant women. That is certainly something we can take as a suggestion and look into doing. But if there's other code words that might be effective in helping pregnant women to quit smoking, for example, you might type in trigger and you'll be able to get a specific response related to that keyword. So there are certain keywords that we have messages that relate to specific needs that a person might have in quitting, and some of them may be relative to the pregnant smoker.
Next question comes from Robin Clark. Robin, please state your question.
Yes, I was wondering if you had watched the percentage of numbers of significant others of a child who was a patient at the Children's Hospital that with a child that had respiratory issues, asthma, low birth weight, any of the normal things you would see in a typical cigarette more than 10 a day pregnancy, if those parents or significant others had a higher quit rate than a child who was doing pretty okay at birth.
So that's exactly the question we are, you know, trying to answer with a study that we are in the middle. We just finished collecting our data, and that really was our question. You know, is it Is and we chose the neonatal population because we know that they've been studied as a potential target group. And so we had thought that perhaps the people who were in the NICU would be, the parents in the NICU would be more likely to quit than the parents in the nursery. Right now it looks like we actually have the opposite effect, and we don't know if it's because they're just not ready to hear anything because their baby is so sick. We haven't really looked through all the data yet. We have a lot of data to sift through, but that is, that has been shown with older children in some small studies, and older children admitted, say, with asthma, for example, that those parents, when approached to quit, were perhaps more ready to quit and more open to receiving therapy and counseling and so forth. But we really don't know enough about what's sustainable and, if these are really target populations. So this is still a huge unanswered question that I think would be helpful if we could answer it.
Next question comes from Marie Bresnahan. Marie, please state your question.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask a few things about the opt to quit. I wonder about the patient refusals. I know there, I've heard some concerns that people are afraid to have their name sent to the state or afraid that's going to be collected for any, nefarious reasons. So just wondering if you've heard those kinds of objections. And then also wondering how it went with your data transfer. Was the information about whether the quit line contacted that person and how often they followed up and whether they actually successfully quit, was that sent back to you in a timely way? Did it actually get back directly into patient records or sent back to you as a general report?
So Pat Bax can speak to this a little bit more, but I'll tell you what we've done. To answer your first question, I can only give you anecdotal answers at this point. You know, we had, at the same time that we started our the opt-to-quit referral system, we initiated the study. So I had a research assistant in the nursery and then the NICU every day for a year, pretty much. And so she would kind of, she kind of kept her finger on the pulse of who was accepting opt-to-quit referral. My feeling about it, and again, this is not data-driven because we don't have data on this really, is those who did not accept the referral was because they didn't want to stop smoking. I don't think she said to me at all once, I don't want my, she would come back and tell me, well, this person is not ready to quit smoking, this person, whatever, but not, they were afraid to give their name. Somehow that didn't seem to be an issue. I'm sure that it might be. In which case, when somebody would say to us, well, we're not ready to do this, but maybe we'll consider it, then we hand them the information that we all have, which is the printed information, 1-800-NEW-YORK-QUITS, whatever, give them the phone number so that they can do this on their own terms. And that's still helpful because you've had the discussion with them. Part of the beauty of the opt-to-quit system is that it does make it sort of a standard protocol for everybody so that it is in the system. And so whether the person accepts the referral through the EMR or they accept a piece of paper, at least the conversation has been initiated, which, as Dr. Griffin pointed out, doesn't always happen. To speak to the data transfer, that was a little bit of a bear, but it does work. The data does get transferred seamlessly from our EMR to them. The way we get the information is I log on to a secure website, and Pat can speak to this a little bit more, to see who has quit and the attempts, and I can get data, all the data that I want that they have collected on who has quit, where they reached, did they decide not to, et cetera. It doesn't show back up in the EMR, which I think is good. And we tell them that when they ask how this works. We say, none of this opt-to-quit data goes back into the EMR. The only thing that's in the EMR is your name and phone number.
I would just like to, if people are worried about the state learning about their tobacco use, at least at the time of pregnancy, every birth certificate requires us to fill out information about the patient's tobacco use, drug use, a lot of other information. So the state already has this information to begin with anyway, to be honest.
Interesting. Next question comes from Teresa Henkin. Teresa, please state your question.
I was wondering how you work with your postpartum patients when they're breastfeeding if they do want nicotine replacement or any of the medications.
Could you state that again?
Yes. I was wondering how you deal with your postpartum patients that are breastfeeding. do you recommend that they use the NRT or any Wellbutrin?
We've used Wellbutrin in our postpartum patients. We haven't used the NRT as much. We obviously might have done that on a case-by-case basis. Rachel, I don't know if you have any more data on that than I do, but...
You know, I will tell you that there are pediatricians who routinely prescribe NRT for the families of their patients. We don't do that here. But I think that, it's considered off-label because it's not one of the approved uses. On the other hand, if you think about comparing, and again, I think it has to be done on a case-by-case basis, but if you have somebody who you think may benefit from this and they're a heavy smoker, they're going to breastfeed anyway, we know that smoking does produce, significant effects through breast milk. We want mothers to breastfeed, but we find cotinine in the baby's, in the baby's urine if they've been breastfeeding. So it's kind of a balancing act. I think it's probably the lesser of two evils, and I think a lot of people would opt to prescribe it just because otherwise the person may be smoking and it's even worse.
Yep.
Thank you.
Once again, if you do have a question, please press 7 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's 7 on your telephone keypad. We have no further questions at this time.
Great. Thank you, Ryan, and thank you, everybody who participated. Just to let you know, the next webinar will be on Wednesday, May 7th at 12 p.m. And on behalf of the New York State Department of Health, Bureau of Tobacco Control, the Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quitline, I want to express our appreciation to the excellent presentations today and thank all of you for participating in today's call. This will bring us to the end. Have a great rest of your day.